Hi, I'm Scott Cooper, and this is the Tales from the Trail podcast by Matchplay. In this episode, Justin Chesham, head coach of Christopher Newport University men's soccer, and I welcome Emily Kwok. In our effort to discuss the pathways and habits of high performers, Emily is highly qualified to bring that to our podcast. Emily was a world champion in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and now works as a peak performance consultant with Josh Waitzkin. Their clients include professional sports teams, tech innovators, impact-oriented finance groups, and enterprises that are redefining their respective industries. There's a lot to learn from Emily in this discussion. Thank you to Adam Benayoun for the introduction.
Emily, I was listening to you on the Raspberry Ape podcast, which, what a sweet name, by the way. I'd like to get some background on that one. But you pretty early on were mentioning some movies that inspired you. And I was thinking about, all right, well, what movies inspired me? And I was thinking, you know, I was a kid when Rudy was around being in sports. I was like, oh man, such a cool story. And then I'm a big Russell Crowe guy. So like Gladiator was cool, but Cinderella Man, a boxing movie. And you know, you were in boxing early on. And I remember in that theater standing up, cheering him on in the last fight. It's a movie. It's not even real. It's acting, but it was so cool and so inspiring. And so you'd mentioned a few movies. So I was, I love cinema. My motivational movies have changed now. It's like Deadpool. Like I just want to laugh now when I watch a movie. But what are your favorite movies that are inspirational type, sports specific type movies that really motivated you?
So the two movies that kind of influenced me into getting into fighting were, one of them, I mean, I don't consider it a great movie, but the topic was inspiring, and that was Will Smith in the movie Ali. And then the second one was a independent feature. It was the first movie, I believe, by the director Karen Kusama, and it was also the first movie with Michelle Rodriguez, who went on to, you know, star in all sorts of Fast and Furious films. But it was a small independent film called Girl Fight. And it was about this young girl who was growing up with a single father and a younger brother in Brooklyn. And she had to basically take her brother around to boxing class and look after him, even though she really wanted to box. And nobody ever wanted to invest in her, right? And so it's this coming of age story of this young woman who decides that she wants to fight and you know, kind of turns the tables in terms of getting people to believe in her and the amount of work and sacrifice she had to put in to make that happen. I found it to be a really inspiring film, and I didn't know at the time that it was just a model also for what would happen when I started training in jiu-jitsu and in MMA and constantly being told nobody wants to watch you fight, or you know, girls are a problem, we don't want you in the gym, or there's nobody for you to train with. And I religiously watched Girl Fight every time the night before I went to compete in a competition. I don't know why. I must have seen the movie like hundreds of times because there was just something very inspiring and hopeful for me in knowing that she was an underdog, but she would come back and win against everybody. So those are my two biggest films, I would say, coming up. Maybe a little bit before then, it's not so much of a martial arts film, but definitely one of my favorite films of all time. Martial arts related, because the star was, you could say, part of a martial arts legacy. But I'm not sure if you guys ever saw The Crow with Brandon Lee. It was adapted from a graphic novel, and it is more a story of vengeance. But Brandon Lee was the son of the great Bruce Lee and was tragically killed during the film. But that movie, too, was just about someone being able to come back and, you know, get the bad guys when nobody believed in them. And so I think there's something for me about always wanting to, like, root for the underdog or the person that's not going to make it. And so those would be sort of like my big three.
Yeah, I actually heard you say the Girl Fight one, and I popped on YouTube to go kind of do a little research on it. And I mean, I remember Michelle Rodriguez from the Fast and Furious movies, and she's a badass in those movies. And I'm like, man, what a perfect character. Like, I wouldn't want to fight her, like, at all. I mean, she's She's very top. I think she punches people in Fast and Furious too. So it was pretty easy for Brian to knock out that role. But now, right before we hopped on, we were talking about kids' ages, and you've got three little kiddos, and I do as well. And I'm really excited about this because I drive past a jiu-jitsu place on my way to work. And I've always wondered, because I really want my kids to do it. And I've always wondered, when do I start? And do they have like parent, you know, father, son classes where I can go grapple with my son and bring it home and he could teach me some stuff? Because I didn't do it growing up. So, but I would love to get him involved with that. And so first question, at what age can I start? And what do you recommend there?
Well, good question. I think some of it is always going to be dependent on what is offered in and around you, right? So not every city or town will be as developed. And, you know, there is real no template for this is the way a jiu-jitsu school looks and these are the classes we're going to have. So, for example, you just spoke about parent and child. Like, I think parent and child engagement is super important, increasingly important today, because we tend to not engage with our kids, you know, in play. Like, a lot of the times we let them go watch TV or we let them get on their iPads and devices. And it's a beautiful time when your children are young to be embodied with them and to also demonstrate and enact what strength you have as a human to come back from, you know, falling down and getting back up, or, you know, having a wrong move done to you and then you being able to brush yourself off and get back up again. And parent and child classes are wonderful, but not all schools will have them. At my school in New Jersey, Princeton Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, we start at 4 years old. I would say I've worked with children since the age of 14. I used to run day camps. I used to teach children's programs long before I did jiu-jitsu. And 4 to 6 years old is, I think, the first developmentally, it's sort of the age where they can start to pay attention for maybe more than 15 to 30 minutes doing something, right? So our 4 to 6 year old program is for 45 minutes. And we have, you know, we try to have like five kids to at least one instructor. And a lot of the exposure is technical, but also we try to throw a lot of games and engagement in there because the kids want to play. Ultimately, the goal of that program, I would say, with children a lot of the times is not necessarily at my school to build the most technical fighters at 6 years old. We're not super competitive that way. As a parent and as an instructor and someone who's worked with children for a long time, I actually look at the jiu-jitsu class or the jiu-jitsu school as a laboratory to help, or a gym, you could say, to help them learn skills like resilience and confidence and self-awareness, self-control. And I know that, you know, in martial arts, it gets very cliche. You see those words up on windows and on plaques and people recite them, but it really is about cultivating an embodied practice. And in jiu-jitsu, whether you're a child or an adult, it's about theory and application. And I think increasingly in the world today, we're dealing with a lot of theory and a lot of ideas of what we're supposed to do, but few humans who actually go do them. So teaching that at a young age and not even articulating that, but just like having them go do it builds a habit of like, I'm going to go do what I say I'm going to do, right? And like, that's to me what I'm after.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I was hoping you said that. I definitely want to get them involved. Every time I hear, you know, watching podcasts and, you know, Joe Rogan's doing it, Jocko Willink, these guys that I really like to listen to, they talk about jiu-jitsu all the time. And they use one of my favorite words, and that's discipline. And when you're dealing with a six-year-old, just complete chaotic kid and a four-year-old girl who's even crazier than the six-year-old boy, I would love any type of help at all in that world. So, I'll be signing them up for one of those camps this summer. I'm glad you said that early because I was really hoping to jump in that quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are, this is probably my phrase the whole podcast, increasingly in a world where people are afraid to have boundaries, people are afraid to say what's wrong and right, people don't know how to navigate the system. And that's not to say that there's a spectrum, a very wide spectrum of what can be wrong and right. The problem is developmentally as children and as humans, we need to have a ladder to climb before we can deconstruct the ladder and make something better, right? And so I think when it comes to discipline for me, it really is boiled down to consequences for your actions. It can't just be okay all the time. Can't be okay when you make a mistake on your math test. Can't be okay when you lose the match. Can't be okay when you punch some kid in the face that you shouldn't. Like, we need to demonstrate and give children guidelines for how they can and should behave. And in a jiu-jitsu class, because it is a physical discipline where you're touching and grabbing another human and it's with consent, it teaches you how to have respect for not only another human, but also for yourself. And there's few things that allow us to do that today, right? Because a lot of team-oriented sports, some of these things are no contact, and or other martial arts might involve quote-unquote discipline and forms, but they're not doing it with another human. And the problem is not what you do by yourself. The problem we're running into today is we don't know how to deal with other people. And so the discipline that you begin to experience as you're grabbing and being jostled and thrown and get back up, like, these are all invaluable moments that I think will help build better humans. And it just, it comes down to, hey, if you do X, you will suffer Y, you know, good or bad.
No, I love that. Absolutely love that.
Yeah. Emily, so talk about some of the things that, you know, it, as a young kid who starts in martial arts, jiu-jitsu specifically, what are some of the lessons that you're seeing them carry through as they develop and mature and become young adults? And, you know, could be applicable to other things in life, could be applicable to playing another sport. And how does that contribute to them being successful human beings?
I think that it's funny. I get a lot of parents that will sometimes come in and they'll say, oh, I have two children. And my, you know, my older kid is kind of reserved and doesn't know how to stick up for themselves. And I was hoping that the jiu-jitsu class would help them develop some confidence and figure out how to handle who they are. But my younger one is a little unruly and they're a little wild. And I was hoping that the jiu-jitsu class would kind of like set them straight. And what's interesting is, like, a lot of times the kids that are a bit wild or unruly, sometimes they're like doing it because they want the attention. Sometimes they're doing it because they can just get away with it. And what's interesting about being in a class where you can't just get away with things is that you do see things even out, right? You do see behaviors temper, because a lot of times the reaction that kids are looking for is, hey, is someone paying attention to me? So when you're in a high touch environment and you have adults or humans that are sort of monitoring and facilitating that, I do believe that they, for, you know, whatever, the 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours that they might be training a week, they have people's undivided attention and they have people's undivided touch. Touch is also an extremely important thing, I believe, developmentally. Some kids don't get hugged. I didn't grow up getting hugged. I was from an Asian family. And learning to feel other humans, learning to feel them before they even touch you is an important skill. And these are the kinds of things that I think they feel a little bit intangible at first. But what we've had some children that started with us when they were like, you know, 5 or 6 years old, and they're in college now. You know, I've had my school for 14 years. And I have to say that a lot of them have grown up to be just really wonderful humans, compassionate souls. I have one kid who is in college now, the gentlest soul you could imagine. And he's grown into quite the beast of a young man and would never hurt a fly. But he's skilled enough that when people do bully him or try to bully someone that he cares about, he also knows how to throw down. And so it's developing that self-control to know when it's appropriate to use your assets or use your skills versus when you can handle things other ways. We all need a place to express our frustrations. Most of us don't have that, especially as we get into adulthood. There's very few places where we, when we say we just want to, like, you know, punch a hole in the wall, we can't do that. Jiu-jitsu gives you a place where you can and you appropriate it. So I think it's like the boundary making and just like knowing how you should function, you know, in an ecosystem where it's just yourself versus affecting other humans is incredibly important. And I think also, like, as young girls or young boys, like, as a woman, I'll say we weren't really cultivated or raised to think it was okay to grab people or to jostle. I know with boys, it's much more common to roughhouse. Now, it's important to know what you can and can't do, not just from a social boundary perspective, but also in yourself. What am I capable of doing? Can I run away? Can I kick? Can I grab? Can I choke? Can I do all of these things? So it's a big confidence builder because it just helps people get out of the subjective and more into the objective and realize, oh, these are the things I'm empowered to do. These are the things I have to work on. These are the things I really can't do. And that also keeps you out of trouble. So I don't know that these things are always articulated. I think we always kind of go, oh, like we learn honor and respect and we learn how to, you know, treat others with kindness. But when you really drill down to it, I think jiu-jitsu can offer so much more.
Yeah, I heard a podcast where it was talking about men, specifically men, but I think it applies to women as well, that he made the comment that men should be dangerous, which the reporter backed like, dangerous, that sounds like a problem. He goes, well, no, learn how to be dangerous, but most importantly, learn how to control it, know when to use it, and be able to use it. And if the situation calls for it, you can be that way and not the opposite of that. And like, oh no, I need to be dangerous here and I can't be, I don't know how to do it. And so learning those foundations early, and that only helps you know how to control that. I mean, I find that so valuable. I'm 41. I wish that I was doing it at 6 now. Someone would be jealous of my son.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people have heard the saying, like, everyone wants to fight until they get punched, right? Like, I've punched people. Like, I fought MMA in a time that it was not cool or cute for girls to fight MMA. I've been punched in the head and kicked in the gut and thrown down by full-grown men and gotten back up and had to do it again. So I am very well aware of what I can and can't tolerate. I know when I'm in real danger versus this is like an empty threat. But we can't actually know when there's a real threat imposed on us if we don't get close to the line and actually know what is there. And I think that we have tended to get to this place where we like to talk a lot about what we think we can do, but few of us are actually willing to put in the effort and sacrifice to see what we can or can't handle, right? Mm-hmm. And so in jiu-jitsu, you cannot get away with training unless you're training with another human. And in most places, I would say that women are often training with men. It's nice to be able to train with other women. It's not always possible. But, you know, the positive side effect, it's frustrating, but the positive side effect is, as a woman, if I'm 150 pounds and I'm paired up with a 200-pound guy, I learn to be aware of, like, how I can defend myself or not, you know? And it's uncomfortable, but I always tell people we're in the business of teaching people how to become comfortable being uncomfortable. Because, you know, I had a parent say this to me once when they brought their kids into my school. I said, why did you come to jiu-jitsu? And they said, there are two skills that my children will learn living under my roof until they leave. There's no choice in this. And I said, what's that? And they said, they're going to learn how to fight and they're going to learn how to swim. Because these are two life skills where if you don't know how to do either one of them, you could find yourself in a whole lot of trouble. You could lose your life. And this wasn't like a hardcore, you know, conservative human who felt like everyone was a threat. This was just life skills. Like, what life skills are we giving our children today? And the fact of the matter is we don't. Like, a lot of us don't give our children coping mechanisms. Critical thinking has gone out the window. We don't teach our children how to sit through frustration. We don't teach our children how to navigate through boredom. Like, we don't give them the space. So I think that that having a discipline like jiu-jitsu is a great way to expose them and empower them to learn how to develop these things.
Yeah. Let's delve into kind of the other side of it, and that's kind of developing and maintaining a student mindset, so to speak, as you go through life. And you had a podcast called Master and the Apprentice, right? Mm-hmm. I believe that's the title, right? And so people think that you have to strive to be the master, but if you lose the student mindset, then you're kind of missing out and you're missing the boat, right? So kind of delve into
the thinking behind that and how you teach people, you know, in your business, how to maintain the student mindset.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I would actually say the higher the level, the performer that I work with, and just to give context, you know, I not only work with some elite athletes, but work in a world with, you know, hedge fund managers and founders and just great creative minds. From that podcast, you'll see that I got to interview different types of artists and musicians and athletes. And I think that the higher the level of a human I was working with, the more they oriented to always having a beginner's mind, never believing that they actually had it all. I think we all look for some sense of belonging, some status for some of us, some power. And we think that we can achieve those things by being the best or being like really good at that thing, right? Or climbing to the top of the corporate ladder. The reality is nobody has the complete picture. Nobody has the answer. And creativity doesn't exist if we don't always seek to reach into the void. And so a lot of the work that I do with professionals, it really orients around helping people understand that once you reach the top of the socialized ladder, and I'll call it the socialized ladder because it's sort of the value system that most of us see, there's no peak to chase after. There's no template. There's no path to the top of the next mountain because you actually have to learn how to create it yourself. And so I think that when it comes to the beginner's mind and why jiu-jitsu has been a great laboratory for me to continuously experience it is you learn to be humbled every day by all the things you don't know, right? It's important to be humbled every day. A lot of us stop being humbled when we get an education, we get a job, and we start climbing the ladder. Instead of being humbled, we want to humble everyone else and then make ourselves feel better about it. But I think the higher the level of the mind, you find that they're always curious and they're always grounded and no question is ever too dumb or stupid to ask. For me, I never thought jiu-jitsu was going to be my path. I started doing it because it was fun and it was different. Years later, I'm still in it, but I also find myself wanting to explore other disciplines. So I am trying to learn how to surf. I'm trying to learn how to toe surf. I'm trying to learn how to foil. Like I'm trying to learn these activities that are really, really difficult. In fact, I have a black eye from 2 weeks ago because I got hit with my board. I don't know what I'm doing in the water. I'm having to start at ground zero. And I actually love it because one, I can start to see what a better student I've become. I've become less defensive. I don't posture as much when someone wants to correct me. In fact, now I crave the feedback. Whereas in before I used to be like, why is this person telling me this? Like, of course I know how to do this. Didn't they see me the last round? Now it's like, tell me what else I don't know. Film me, like show me what I'm doing wrong, right? And then there's also liberation in the fact that I don't have to know anything. I've been doing jiu-jitsu for 25 years and people always expect you to have the answers. And you don't. You don't always have the answers. And sometimes you just don't want to have the answers because when the pressure builds and people expect you to do something, you can't just be anymore. You have to be something for someone else. You can't just be you for you, right? So having that humility to just say, I just want to learn. I just want to be a beginner. It allows you to feel free. And that feeling I never want to lose.
Right. So you talked about, you know, being more open to not criticism necessarily, but just, you know, instruction and pointers and that sort of thing. And that's a level of vulnerability and that you've learned to adapt and grown into, I guess, is maybe a good way to put it. But, you know, talk about the importance of that open-mindedness and being willing to have those discussions and being a good listener and understanding, you know, what the person is the input that the person is trying to give you. And you know, that transcends everything and everything, every endeavor that we, you know, take on. And so talk about the importance of that and, you know, how you've seen that be effective in not only your life, but, you know, the people that you work with.
So it's hard to tell someone you have to learn to be more vulnerable, right? Like, you'll be better if you just accept this feedback, because you're fighting an assumption that they may have that, like, they're not good enough, or they're better than everybody, like whatever the story is that's going on in their head. And it's like, you know, trying to tell somebody, be more humble, be more patient, be more this, be more that. Anytime you introduce the word like "you should," it puts someone's defenses up. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to taking your emotions out of it, and if you are thinking about optimization and how to be better at something, we don't get better operating in our own echo chamber, because logic and reality would say, like, no, you don't have all the answers. And if you were to talk to a Michael Jordan, or, you know, whoever's best in class at whatever the sport or the industry is, they had to work really hard to get to where they got to. It's just that we don't always get to see that, right? Like, one of the first interviews I did on that podcast, was the Master and the Apprentice, was with the hip hop artist Lupe Fiasco. And I mean, he's won a Grammy Award and he's widely celebrated, but there's a portion of that interview that really always sticks with me. And it's that he said at some point in time, he decided he wanted to be a rapper, but he realized he didn't have enough words to rap. So he just started reading and, like, going through the dictionary. He had to learn more words. If he thought that he was good enough, he would have continued rapping with, like, I don't know, 1,000 words the rest of his life. But he had to open himself up to actually get to a better place. And so when I'm working with different individuals, I always find that optimal performers, the ones with the right mindset, never have a problem being vulnerable, because they've already learned the lesson of, the more open I am to creating feedback loops and seeing those things, going back and having a critical eye, not just with myself, but with my coach or with people on my team or people that care about me, the more information I can extract to make my performance better. The people that are less vulnerable are the ones that usually, I would say developmentally, they have something that they need to protect within their ego, or they're more socialized and they're always looking to jockey for their place. And sometimes that means that, you know, the work can't be done until you get them to a place where they can let their guard down. So sometimes it's helpful to understand what it is that's making them feel self-conscious, why it is that they don't want the extra feedback, why they externalize the way that they think so much. And usually there's something psychologically that's deep-rooted in them that they're not certain about. When you're dealing with younger athletes, the reality is they're still developing. They're not fully humans yet, you know, like their brains aren't there yet. So providing equal amounts of support and challenge can help open that gate. Right. So I've spoken about this on other podcasts, and this was something that I learned from adult development, is you can't grow if you don't have the right amounts of support and challenge. And as coaches and as parents, something that we can do is we can try to help manage what that spectrum looks like. What I mean by that is, if you support the individual too much, you give them tasks that are too easy, and you don't stretch them, it becomes boring, right? So, like, they're not engaged because it's too, they already know the solution. They already know how to do the thing. On the flip side, I'm sure we've all experienced having a coach, a teacher, a parent that has given too challenging of a task, something that's way beyond your limits. Maybe it's too far of a run, or it's too many kicks, or it's a technique that you're just not quite ready for. And when you stretch somebody too far, they also disengage and they don't open up, because they go, I can't do this. I don't believe in myself. This is too hard. And so when you go too far in either direction, you shut down the opportunity to create flow, create openness. But when you open and you tap into the right spectrum, that's where the sweet spot is, where when they start experiencing success, they go, oh, like, give me more of that. I want to feel that again, right? Not, oh, this totally sucks, I just want to go home. Right. And so as a coach, I take that challenge very seriously. When I go teach, I teach a lot of seminars and camps now. And when I go into a room where I don't know the humans, my first task is to try to use language to get in and, like, meet people at their level. Super important. Meet them at their level and then read the room and see how I can push those, like, crank those levers up and down, support and challenge, support and challenge. And how to help them do that with each other. And the more successful we become at doing that, the more flow you can create, and the more engaged that learner becomes.
So you're talking, using the word flow. Talk more about that word and what that means, and go from there.
Yeah.
And then we can.
I can never pronounce the author properly, but Mihaly's Chick something or other. but it was it's kind of this he's a psychologist that sort of brought this idea forward that there are optimal performance and learning states, and we can induce them. It's not just a magical thing that happens. You know, like I've expressed to a lot of people when I'm surfing, right? Like there's a moment when I catch the wave, and when I do catch the wave and I get up and I'm having a great ride, time slows down and it is the best feeling in the world, because everything is just, it just clicked in and you feel like I got the paddle right. I popped up right. I'm able to start steering my board. And it's just this feeling of complete liberation and openness. And then it's what makes me want to go back and do it again, because surfing is hard. In jiu-jitsu, it's, you know, something similar to me going out and competing, and, you know, everyone gets a little bit nervous before they go compete, but it's like being in the zone, listening to some music, tuning people out, getting ready to get on the mats to fight. And then when I'm there, I can tune everything and everybody out and just focus on the match. All I do is hear myself breathing. All I know is what I'm grabbing. Time slows down. Your senses kind of pick up. You may find that, you know, things aren't like, it's almost like a cartoon. Like you go in and you're able to zero in on the exact thing that you want to be able to do. But it's a state that's usually induced by what I was just talking about, this like support and challenge. Like this is also one of those factors. When you can help humans start experiencing, set up preconditions to experience success, it keeps them in that state where they really open up. And a lot of times when you come out of flow, you remember flow very deeply. You remember how much that channeled to your ability to accomplish something and do it in a very, very good way. It's also a state that you remember later on. Maybe you're at another game, you're at another competition, you're at another surf break, and you can recall that moment where you caught the right wave or you kicked the ball the moment that it needed to be kicked. And it helps you channel your energy into a place that really does unlock your potential and your ability to be the best. It's not mystic. It's not magic power. It's not something that comes and goes. And in optimal performers, you think about how you can create the preconditions to induce that state more and more, so that it's within your, so that you can harness it as opposed to have it be some sort of thing that happens every once in a while.
And you work with a gentleman named Josh Waitzkin, and I read his book, and he like set up an entire process. Or you can talk way better about this than I can, but just creating the same steps to getting to that state, right? That's kind of what you guys.
Yeah.
Do.
So there's a chapter in his book that he talks about called like building your trigger. And he will say today, like looking back, that it's the most prescriptive of the chapters. And by prescriptive, he means like step by step. And one of the things that we try to steer away from is saying that there is a way, right? Like it's not that way for everybody. Everyone's going to have their own recipe. But in principle, the idea is that this idea of building your trigger, how many times do you have people that show up at a game and who knows what they've done to prepare for the game? Maybe they ate McDonald's 15 minutes before because they were at a party the night before. Or maybe they were up super late at night playing video games and they had a sleepover and they're showing up at the tournament the next day. Nobody knows, right? Like everybody's like, oh, but that's just what I felt like doing. And then when they get to the game and it's time for them to perform, they're tired or their head is somewhere else or they're just not with it. There are things that we can control and there's things that we can't control. But some of the things that we can control are really around like, what are the preconditions? Like, what are the conditions we have to set to try to have a good performance? Do we even know that they exist? So maybe the routine is like 24 hours before a game, like I don't eat sugar. 24 hours before a game, I got to make sure that I'm in bed to get 8 hours of sleep so I'm well rested. I pack my bag the night before I go so I'm not scrambling around in the morning when I'm super nervous trying to get everything together. When I get to the game, I try to make sure that I'm there at least 2 hours before so that I have everything that I need. I pack snacks so that I'm not going to be hungry, and I'm packing snacks that are going to energize me, not give me a sugar spike. Maybe there's a special song you like to listen to. Maybe there's a team warm-up you engage in. But the more you can channel and structure certain behaviors that serve the player or serve the team, the more people can trust what's going to happen after that. Right? Problem is, we all show up and we might not be able to trust what's going on because there's no organization to what's going on. So everybody's just running around frantically. I see a lot of fighters when they show up at tournaments, they're like losing their ID. They left their sock in the changing room. They're hungry. So now they're going to have a chocolate bar and somebody gave them a Gatorade. Just chaos. We don't need to have the chaos. So like, what areas within our performance can we actually control to bring us to the present moment? So when I think about optimal performance, it's everything leading up to the moment to be ready to just take it, right? Like there's no extra game plan. There's no extra story. There's no way that it's supposed to be. The most you can do is show up and be at your best so that you can play. Get out of your own way and play. But you cannot get out of your way if you're like, I have a stomach ache because I ate like this burger and I did this and I'm super tired and my foot hurts. That is not an optimal state. So a lot of building your triggers or just becoming aware of your preconditions is like trying to control the things that we can control, not to micromanage, but more so that we can give ourselves some foundation to perform well.
Yeah, I love that. I'm just playing through my mind the difference from when we're on the road as a team staying in a hotel versus I have a 7 o'clock p.m. home game and I don't even see my guys until 5 p.m. And I'm thinking to myself, what have they been doing the last 12 hours? You know, I'm not, they're college kids. I like to think that they're taking care of their business, but I was in college once. I wasn't always taking care of my business. But when I'm on the road, maybe I have a 1 o'clock kickoff. We got there the night before. I know when they're in bed. I know what they're eating the next morning. I know what time they're waking up. I know what game prep we're doing, what we're going to talk about. I mean, they're all right there in front of me and I can kind of control that. And so I love that. The individual triggers is, as you see, I've already got 2 pages of notes. So I will be adding that one to the preseason dialogue.
Well, I think the other thing is like, you know, for you, when you're managing a team, like what I do is so individually based and what you do is individual, but it's team, right? So again, you're going to have a spectrum of humans who are going to have different levels of self-awareness and self-control. And maybe a great idea when you're managing a team would be to consider, okay, here are some individual protocols or things that I want you guys to think about. Don't expect to be the best player on the team if you aren't looking after these things, right? Like it's not rocket science. It's just basic care, right? Now, as a team, what are some team values that you guys can agree upon? And does everyone, like they have to opt in to doing those things, right? So like whenever we've worked with professional sports teams, it's like you cannot have one player or a group of players undermine the values of the team. That doesn't work for cohesiveness on the floor, you know, or on the field. So that might be an idea as well, because if you can get everyone to buy in, that is infectious. Like if, for example, if you have like, I don't know, 20 people on a team, 3 people decide that they want to take their prep really seriously because it's important for them. Maybe they want to play professionally after college, or maybe you have a high school team and they want to get a college scholarship. Well, if it's important to those 3 guys and people see, wow, those 3 players, they are always killing it. They're scoring the most goals. They're getting the most assists. Like they're doing it. And then they go, well, what are they doing? Not rocket science, guys. Like they take care of themselves. How about we do this as a team? See how, let's track our progress. Like how much better can we all get if we all decide to just buckle down and have some discipline around how we want to perform? Performance is not, it's not a gift. You know, like, we have to work for what we have. I am not a gifted athlete. And so everything I have was a matter of me putting in the hours and me wanting to sacrifice those things to a point where it's probably a little crazy to most people, you know? But if you want to be the best, all the people who are the best, they are a little obsessed with what they do. It is not ever enough for them. They can always push a little bit further. And that is an obsession that you can't ask people to have. They have to come to that themselves.
Yeah. And of course, you're talking about the three high achievers that can be infectious, but the other end of that is also infectious, where you've got the three knuckleheads that are drinking the night before a game, or, you know, I'm not going to come in as fit this year, or, you know, the terrible diet, all those little things that you're not really thinking about because you're not in the moment, you're not on the field, you're not in the court. And it, of course, has a massive effect on you. That can also be infectious. And when you're speaking in front of a crowd and you have a CEO and four seats over is someone maybe lowest on the payroll, you know, or you've got a head coach, you've got a director or whatever, and you also have the new guy that hasn't played a minute on the team yet. You've got those two people, highest and lowest end of the spectrum. How is your message touching both of them? How are they both going to grab from that? Or do you have to specify? You have to kind of specialize it for each one? Or can you tell them one or two things and they're like, oh, I'm eating this up just as much as the CEO is?
Well, the thing is, it's not... CEOs are often a really poor example. Just because you made it to the top of the ladder in that corporate setting doesn't mean that you actually know what the hell you're doing. Same thing with, you know, you observe it on sports teams. Sometimes the people that get all the attention are not getting attention for the right reasons, right? Like, what we deem to be successful sometimes is like warped and backwards. And it's interesting, like I'm working with a team now and like in a corporate setting, some of the most engaged humans are not the ones at the top. In fact, the closer to the top you get, the less engaged they are, because for them, it's like, I made it. What do you mean I have to work harder? What do you mean I have to optimize? I'm at the top. The problem is it trickles top down. And when you have hustlers on the bottom, like, this is the thing, the people that are newly acquired, the people that are not upper level management and want to climb their way up, they are hungry. And they are going to say, how do I get there? What do I have to do? And they are paying attention because they are willing to bite you. They are willing to push you out of the way. They're willing to do above and beyond what everybody else has because they want what you have, right? Now, if you can create and cultivate an environment where everybody is churning like that, then you have a really dynamic culture and you see success on all levels. But a lot of the times the people who need to mobilize are not the ones that are, you know, at the bottom. A lot of the times it's the ones at the top. The other thing I'll say is new hires or new team members sometimes are your greatest assets because they might not be culture carriers of what's negative already in the ecosystem. When you have new people, you have the opportunity to train them with a better mindset so that they introduce a different kind of energy and like motivate everybody else, right? So like when you think about the three drunk players or the ones that undermine the team, like get rid of them. Even if it's your star player, get rid of them because they are actually obstructing the opportunity for everyone else to gel. Right. And so sometimes you have to make that sacrifice as a coach or as a team captain. Listen, guys, we're either all working together or we're not. And if you're undermining that, you got to go because there's 10 other people here that really want to work hard. And you two doofuses are just like jerking off. So go. You don't need to be here. Right. It's optimal performers are everywhere. You don't have to be the leader. You don't have to be the CEO. You don't have to be the best player on the team. Optimal performance, like that's just a mindset. Those people will eventually be the best, but you might meet them when they're still coming up, right? So the way that I think about optimal performance is I want to work with people who have that fire in them to be the best and help support and sort of protect the space for them to do that work so that they aren't tainted by the negativity that could be around them.
Yeah, and this kind of chimes into what you mentioned earlier, comfort versus, you know, not being comfortable and or being comfortable with being uncomfortable. I mean, such a great point. I think it was John Calipari talked about it in a press conference. Of course, he just got fired or whatever, removed nicely from Kentucky. But he had talked about how his main job was to make these guys uncomfortable in training. So when the game rolled around, this was a national championship year, so he could talk about this pretty cleanly. But those guys were fine. They're like, oh, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the situation that we're in here. And I love your point about new people. So in my job, I cycle through players naturally. Every 4 years, I graduate somebody. Well, I guess every year, but they get 4 years. I graduate people and new guys come in. It's just a natural thing. I'm not firing them and, you know, hiring new guys and like that. They're just leaving and coming in. And I got to tell you what, the new guys, I always love them because of what you talked about. They they are just eyes wide open. They want to make a point. They're super naive. Like, I can tell them anything and they're going to be like, you got it, coach. I'll run through this wall. Understood. Got it. Whatever it is you need me to do, I'll do. And I mean, some of my most favorite teams I've ever had have been very young teams, freshmen, sophomores that hadn't played much as freshmen. So they're just trying to prove themselves. And we just graduated a bunch of guys. So it's their turn now. And man, those are some of my favorite teams I've ever had. So I love that point. Absolutely love that point.
Yeah. And I think that it's, you know, you guys are, I it sounds like, you know, and just ignorantly from where I am looking at soccer as an organized sport, as a coach, you can't just be someone who decides that you want to coach, I would think, and just like open up a school and have good players, right? Like, or get hired by the best universities. There is, some of it is probably your own playing ability, and some of it is over time, different ways in which your peers have been able to, you know, respect your performance, and you either get nominated for a job or people can see what you do critically and put you into a position of power. In Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, it's not that way. So in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you have people who are, you know, let's just say pretty good at doing Jiu-Jitsu, or maybe not even, and they just have some money and they want to like put a school together. You have what I call self-appointed leaders. So like, these are not exactly people who know what they're doing, right? So as a coach, when you know what you're selecting for, you have a choice in what kind of an environment you want to cultivate your players and how you want to integrate them and how you're going to how you're going to grow that over the years to build the type of legacy that you want. Versus in a jiu-jitsu school, like, I'm just a tough person and I just want to train with tough people. So then I cultivate a bunch of meatheads and then it just becomes a meat grinder, right? And like that is a recipe for disaster, but that's really like, we're in a gutter sport. It's what happens most of the time because you have people with very poor education, poor leadership skills that have been led by thugs that are now raising more thugs. Soccer and, like, you know, a lot of the other major sports in America, I would say, are a little bit more refined because there is some sort of a self-checking system in place that doesn't allow anybody to just pop up shop, right? But when you think about what it is that you're trying to build, like, it's more than just that one person's performance. It's like setting the attitude, it's developing their character, it's creating a legacy for that team that they're a part of. And you can demonstrate with them how successful you guys can all be if you decide to orient around the same values. But like, it's very hard when you're dealing with, you know, in some major league sports teams, you have people that inherit teams that just don't care. The player's image is more important than the team itself. And so that is super disruptive in terms of trying to build a winning mindset, right? So like, people have to be able to check themselves and or the team, or at least have awareness around it. And the more you can paint and draw that out for them, hopefully the more they resonate and connect to the idea of like, okay, coach, like, what do I have to do to make the team successful? And what does the team have to do together to make sure that we play? I don't know if you guys have been watching the NBA playoffs at all. But the Celtics have now won two games over the Mavericks. And what's been really interesting to watch is, like, I think that the Celtics generally have a much more cohesive team orientation in terms of how they throw the ball around. Whereas in the Mavericks, they're really orienting around Kyrie Irving and the other player, Joe, forget his name. Joe. So it feels like it's those two guys against the whole Celtics team. And the Celtics team has like bench players that are rotating on. And so like, on some level, it's like almost impenetrable because you see how the team is working together, as opposed to it being like Jaylen Brown or like, you know, Tatum. Like, it's not really about one person. It's about the group. But within the team, of course, like, they all have a mutual understanding and respect, I'm sure, for their positions and what their strengths are. But they've decided to win, we have to come together, right? So like, we all have to have awareness around what those boundaries are and how we orient to everyone.
Yeah. And you're actually, you made a couple of points there, tying them together a little bit, Celtics. And, you know, you're talking about the individual versus the team, and that's harder than it's ever been. I mean, with, you know, my world, you're talking this NIL, these college kids are now making more money than the coaches. And, there's such an environment of, what can you do for me? And, yes. Transaction versus relational. And it's sad because a lot of us jumped into this job not to be rich, because none of us are getting rich, but We just loved it. We loved being around it. We loved being around the sport and the locker room and all that stuff. And, you know, at certain levels, you get to the point where you're like, man, the coach is just there. You're just the guy that's going to get in trouble if we lose games. Nothing else matters. And it's tough now. It's interesting when you see it. You see some of these contracts these kids are signing. I mean, some of these like high school kids making tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars while still in high school. And you're just like, whoa.
Yeah.
That high school coach is making $3,000 for the whole year. It's going to cost him money to run this program. And he's got a player making that. It's so mind boggling.
I think impressive. that's a responsibility that the industry and that the teams have to make, in the sense of, like, I think when you see really highly functional teams, it's because the right leaders and the right levers have been empowered and liberated to make the decisions that they need to make. Right. Mm-hmm. So like if you have a team owner or somebody that's not empowering the coach to really lead, then of course the coach is going to get undermined by all the players. Right. But if it's sort of said and expressed, like, look, if we're going to win, like, you guys need to follow directions and it starts here first. Like, these are all really conscious decisions that need to be made up front, and you need to have leadership and support from the top down. It can't be empowered to a bunch of kids that don't know what to do with themselves, right? It just that is a bad call. But a lot of the times, you know, going back to the conversation about CEOs and, you know, people that are newer in the company, a lot of culture is developed top down. You know, like, people want to see how the top players or how the coach behaves, and then it trickles down to everyone else. So it's important that we try to stand next to and deepen our relationships with the people that really matter, because they demonstrate the behavior for everybody else. And if the rest of the team can see that the leadership, like, you know, the front office or the administration or the top players have a really tight relationship with you or any other coach, then they can see, okay, like, this is functional, like, this is how it should work, right? But, like, to make the choice and put somebody in that position who is like, I'm more important than everybody else, that can really hurt.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I'm seeing it all the time too.
Yeah.
It's tough to walk.
Yeah. Geez, did you say you had to get out of here at 2:00?
No, I'm okay.
I've got a little bit longer too.
Okay, cool.
I'm thoroughly enjoying this. I'd love a little bit longer.
Yeah, it's awesome. I wanted to go back to, so you've literally been the best in the world at jiu-jitsu. You're a world champion. And so what kind of, I want to go back more to, I'm trying to like paint a picture of your mindset as a, you know, a lifelong learner, as a having student mindset. It would have been easy for you to say that was my destination, right? And, you know, there's a lot of talk, you mentioned the NBA, you know, the 76ers have the process, right? And so there's a, this whole notion of engaging in the process. And, you know, a kid who is a student athlete in high school can get a ton of accolades. He can be all state. He can be on an MLS pro team. There's all these different heights that they can reach. And it would be very easy to say, you know, I've made it, or I became pro, or something like that. And so as you were a world champion, what was your mindset to continue learning? What has made you pick up foiling? Like, that seems impossible to me. I can ride a longboard, but I can't imagine trying to ride a foil. So, like, where does that come from? And like, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, how do kids, specifically for the purposes of this podcast, find that mindset? And I know that, you know, a lot of it is difficult to find, and that might not even be the right terminology, but so where they're always learning, they're always growing, so that they're always getting better, rather than worried about their Instagram post when they become a Division I athlete.
Well, I mean, I think that's part of it is, that's a huge part of it is, it's important to learn to orient and prioritize the passion or the joy that you have for something over everything else. Like, it can't be about how many people liked your picture. It can't be about the new sponsorship deal you're going to get. You know, like, those things are nice, but that should not be the leading factor in why you're doing what you do. I think some of my experience is also timing. I started jiu-jitsu when jiu-jitsu was not like a thing. Like I started training in 99. The world championships was still in Brazil. It was kind of an obscure sport. Like you had to go to weird places to learn it. Competitions were just starting up. There were barely any women training. So there was no industry for me to want to be on top of. I was just doing it because it was this weird, fun sport. I didn't know rank was a thing. I just did it. I rejected most of my ranks. Every time someone tried to promote me, I was like, I don't want this. Like, I just want to keep training. But the industry today is very different. People want to do it because they want to say, I'm a black belt. People want to do it because they want to say, I have 10,000 followers. Oh, look at the gi sponsor I have. I'm sure there's similar things that happen in soccer and all these other industries. It's not about the game. It's not about the sport. It's not about the passion anymore. Because if it was, you wouldn't give a crap about any of those things. There has to be a reason for you to do it that's not performative. And quite frankly, part of the a lot of people today are like, why don't you do another instructional? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Why don't you put more videos on Instagram? Like, because I'm not a puppet. I don't want to do things for your attention. If you care about what I do, you'll care about what I do. But I'm going to live my life the way I'm going to live my life. Because now you see people who have become, quote unquote, whatever, jiu-jitsu celebrities or Instagram influencers. They're holding products up and they're making videos to get more likes, but they actually hate their existence. Like they don't want to do that. Or it's a problem. They're like, man, what am I going to record next week? This isn't something that I'm making up. It's just something that I know because I see other people get caught in it. We don't know our limitations. And once you start feeding that machine, you're completely sucked in by it. Why am I surfing? Why am I trying to do all these things? Because it's liberating for me and it's fun for me to do something where I get that feeling of opening up and learning again, right? Because it's not to say that I can't learn anything in jiu-jitsu anymore. Of course, it's one of the only sports that I think continues to evolve. So there's always something to learn. But the wear and tear on my body and the consequence of what I have to pay to do it, it's getting harder and harder. I'm 43. I've had 3 kids. If I go into any given gym and I want to train with the average 4-stripe blue belt, probably a 180-pound dude who might want to beat the crap out of me because I'm a black belt that outranks him and has won a world championship. Like, it's very hard for me to manage all those variables, right? So I still train jiu-jitsu, but I have to pick and choose what I do. When I go and learn something like surfing, I would love to foil. I can't do it yet, right? Like I'm learning, I'm trying to build all the stages in so that I can get there. But it's something new and it's something where I don't have to do it for other people. I am very, very fortunate. I don't know how it happened, but I'm very, very fortunate that somewhere along the line in my athletic career, I've been introduced to some really wonderful influences and humans who have allowed me to really deepen my sense of these values, right? And like Josh having been like a huge influence on me as a friend and as a training partner and as someone that I work with really closely. But it's important to surround yourself with the right kinds of people. I don't keep friends that are performative. I don't keep friends that are users. I don't keep friends that claim status over everything, right? Like I work with, I like having hardworking friends, people that are super humble about what they do. And quite frankly, you need that because if you don't keep humility around you, it's such a slippery slope and you could very easily be like, yeah, I'm awesome. I'm a celebrity. Look at all the perks that I have because of all the cool things that I've done. It's so easy to be there. And it's scary, you know, when you turn around and you go, oh, like, who have I become? Like, is this why I'm doing this? Is this who I need to be? Is this the example I want to set for my children? Right. And so it's really, I don't want to see that in my children. So I have to always try to keep myself in check as well. So eating, pardon my French, but like eating shit every day and like wiping out, having my children see me wipe out, having my children, 2 weeks ago, I had a massive, like, swelling on my face. I looked like Quasimodo and my children were frightened for me, but I was like, I'm okay. They're like, how did it happen? I'm like, the surfboard hit me. Are you going to surf again? Yes, I am. And I make sure that they see me get out there again so that they know that I'm not afraid to try after I fail, right? Like these are more important than like, I need to get 20,000 followers on Instagram. I could give a crap, you know, also the thing is just as quick as people are to like you, how quick are they to turn on you or not pay attention to you when something better comes along, right? And this is something that I see in my gym. When you cater to just competitors, a lot of the times the competitors come because they want something from you. And then when you have nothing left to give, they go somewhere else and they do not give a crap about your culture. They don't care about you. So I just would rather not, you know, it's, and that's my choice. I know that there's plenty of places that they could go to that are better off for them, but I try to orient around my values. And although it's difficult, I try to surround myself with people that help me do that. And at this point, I would say I've seen enough success from sticking to my guns that way that I'm like, I wouldn't trade this for the world. I don't have a lot of drama in my life. I don't have high turnover in my school. I don't have weird, like, you know, cat fights and like drama that and politics. I just try to stay out of it. And I'm a happier person for it.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're bringing this up. I just wrote down, tie this into family. And, you know, you're working, my favorite thing in the world, two things, 1A, 1B, it's my wife and my children, 1A, 1B. I try to keep the wife ahead, but the little ones yell a little too much right now. But you're dealing with high performers. And too often you see high performers fail on the family side of things. I mean, they're just so into that. They struggle. They struggle to keep, to be home, man. Or even if they don't fail there, they, at the end of it, almost regret it or say, I wish I was around more for my kid. Like, I just saw my daughter's dancer side over the weekend and it was so cool. You know, she's dancing to some Disney song or whatever. She knows like two moves, but I'm glad I was there. And I just can't help but think you've got all these great, you've got such great advice for the high performer, the optimizing the self, such amazing, wonderful advice, but you're a great mother too. And how do you balance all that? And could you have imagined doing all that right in the thick of your training towards being a world champion? And, you know, how do you put all that together? How do you be a high performer, but still come home and be the greatest dad, greatest mother, husband, whatever you could possibly be, and balance all of that throughout your life?
Well, thank you for the compliment. I think the jury's out on whether I'm the world's best or worst mom, depending on who you ask. But you raise a really good point, which is that I chose not to have children until I felt like I was ready to. Because in my mind, I was like, yeah, I want to have my first kid when I'm 28. And then, you know, I had it all planned out. But when I was 28, I was still in the heat of, you know, trying to compete in the adult divisions and trying to make my way back in. And I knew that I wanted my life for me. And I just want to say to all the parents out there and people who will be parents one day, it is so important to be selfish and acknowledge when you want something for you versus you're ready to give it up for somebody else. I think the biggest mistake that we make, and I've seen it in other humans, is when we give up our own independence and autonomy and our dreams and our goals because we're like, oh, it's time to have a family, or it's like, I want to do this thing. I want to donate my time to this cause, right? I'm going to volunteer. I'm going to coach. I'm going to do this. And we're not ready for it. There's the argument that you're never ready for anything. But when I decided to have my first child, I was at a point in my life where I felt like I could be satisfied with what I'd done for myself. I wasn't going to resent having a child and giving up time training because I was going to be going to like mommy and me classes, right? And at the time in jiu-jitsu, there were no master's divisions for women. So I kind of stopped competing at like 32, 33, thinking, okay, like, I'm not the best in the world, but like, you know, in terms of the amount of accolades I've collected, but I've done enough. I'm satisfied. And so I let it go. I was fine to let it go. And I did let it go. And for 6 years, I focused on being a mom and building a school. And I had two kids. But then in 2018, one of my students had been on a campaign to help get more women into jiu-jitsu and to make more master's divisions so that older women could feel that there was a place for them to compete versus like, you know, you have like a 45-year-old mom who wants to compete in jiu-jitsu and she has to fight against a 21-year-old, right? Like that's really tough. Not to say it can't happen, but it's tough. And so when she launched that campaign with some other people in the community, I was like, okay, I'll go back and I'll support because they introduced master's divisions at the World Master's Worlds that year. So in 2018, after 6 years of not competing, I came back and I won. And then in, I think it was 2022, 2023, I went back and I did another Masters, the European Championships, the Pan Ams 2 times. I won another 5 competitions. I was undefeated. I had 0 points scored against me. I was a better athlete as a middle-aged mother than I ever was at the peak of my career. And it was because I had sorted my boxes and been like, this is for me, this is for you. And when I have time for me, I'm going to give it 1000%. And when I'm going to be a mom, I'm just going to be a mom. And so I try to make a clear, I work a lot. I love my work. I love traveling. I love being able to work with people the way that I do. But I am very clear with myself on if today is like, if at 4 o'clock, it's mommy takes you to the park or we're going to the beach, like mommy takes you to the park and we're going to the beach. Because I find that where I get frustrated is when I try to do me and my kids are around. Right. Yep. So I have to be like, this is me time. This is kids time. When people say, are you sad when you travel and you aren't with your children? I'm like, hell to the no. I was like, this is me time. When I spend me time, I go back and I'm a better mom for it. So I just try not to ignore and neglect my own personal impulses because I see a lot of parents who give themselves away for their families. And I listen, that is a noble cause. And if that is you, I love that for you. But I know me. Yeah. And if I did that, I would be a miserable human being for myself and for my family.
Yeah. I mean, being able to separate is critical. Absolutely. To imagine working while you have little rugrats running around screaming, and it's just an impossibility, and bringing them to work is just as bad, if not worse. And, you know, I think that tying in a topic from earlier, the triggers, there's no reason why you can't be doing that for both what you have going on in your life. Like I'm going to prepare today for what tomorrow's asking for. I've got me time separated. I've got little kid time separated, and I'm all organized and I'm ready to go. And I think that's beautiful advice. I love that.
And it's going to be different for everybody, right? Like what's right mm-hmm. for me is not going to be right for you, is not going to be right for somebody that's listening to this podcast. What's important optimally for any human, whether you're going to be, you know, your job in terms of optimization is to make the best version of you. Right. And like, who cares what everybody else thinks? The best version of you. Do you know what that looks like? If you don't, that's where you should do some soul searching. It doesn't matter if you're best in class for everybody else, but like, how do you live your best life? And absolutely. I think that, you know, my values will not be your values. My normal will not be your normal.
Still there?
Okay. Can you hear me? My normal will not be your normal. And that's fine. That's not for anybody to judge, right? Like that's, you have to decide what's going to make you happiest in your life. But we run into trouble when we start orienting towards what we think everybody else or everything else needs from us, and we're not serving ourselves. And so when people are like, why would you move to Costa Rica? Or like, that's so crazy. And I'm like, because the world got really fast and I found that I was responding to everything and everybody else except for me. Like I didn't have room to think. And today, you know, I can wake up in the morning at sunrise and make my kids breakfast, send them to school, be here when they come back, make dinner with them. Like I'm eating breakfast and dinner with my kids almost 7 days a week. That was an impossibility in New Jersey. Impossibility. Okay. Because it was 20 minutes to gymnastics practice, 30 minutes to the gym. Oh, I got to go run some errands. I have to do, oh, here, go get some Chick-fil-A. Okay. Maybe we were eating once or twice a week together. And so these are the kinds of trade-offs you make when you're like doing you versus you're doing them versus you're doing your family. And I am in a position of privilege where I can sit and actually make these choices. I know that sometimes we cannot, it's just not that time in our life. And I feel for you, but I think the more awareness we develop around what we want to be happiest, and once we understand what that picture can look like, then we can start doing things to help get us there, right? But we can't get there if we can't define it.
That's beautiful. Right. Emily, this has been great. Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, I'm gonna get back in touch with you to figure out how to be an expat. Come down there. it's beautiful place. I love it down there.
Bring Adam down. We'll do a camp.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he's started a great school. You know, I don't know how much you've kept up with him, but he's doing a great job. He's awesome.
So yeah, Adam's a good human. I root for more humans like Adam because God knows in jiu-jitsu we need them. Mm-hmm. I say this a lot. Like, I'm tired of seeing the jiu-jitsu world put on blast. Toxic behaviors and things that we don't want to see in people. I think we need to do a better job shouting out the humans that are doing the right things so that we can all have better examples of people to follow. So Adam's one of those people, and you're very lucky to be able to train with him.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm so grateful to have come across him. So, and yeah, for making this connection. So
yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Emily.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to hit stop.